I mean, yeah, I grew up in Cull Island in County Tyrone, and I lived there most of my life until I moved to Belfast when I was 18. And I guess I have very clear memories of being in Cull Island with my dog Patch, who used to follow me around everywhere. When I grew up I was born in 1991. There actually wasn't a lot of girls around where I lived, so it was all boys around the same age. So I remember hanging around with them quite a lot and trying to play hide and seek and stuff, but Patch always used to give me away because his bum would be sticking out and his tail would be wagging and just be stubby tail. But I was always never really good at hide and seek because he was always following me, which I loved, and he was my best friend. But I definitely remember going down to the shop with him in the morning and stuff to get stuff for my dad and coming back up. I remember that really well.
That's class, man. Childhood pets, they are extremely special. Like, no, it was awesome. So yeah, look, if you've just jumped in, hello and welcome. This is Best of Belfast, the podcast that celebrates Northern Ireland and the incredible people in it. Today's episode is part of our ongoing series with NI Connections, where we have the chance to share stories of incredible people from Northern Ireland who are living and working overseas. And Sheree, you're in London, isn't it?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, awesome. So to see a list of other episodes featured in the series, you can head to niconnections.com, which is where you can also sign up for a free monthly newsletter featuring our exciting and far-reaching global community. So you've been hearing already from Sheree Atchison, and just a little bit about Sheree, just to set the context for the rest of the conversation. Sheree is listed as one of the UK's most influential women in tech. She's a regular contributor at publications like Forbes, Fast Company, Business Insider. She's worked for the likes of Deloitte, Monzo, and is currently the Global Director of Diversity and Inclusion at Peakon. Her book, Demanding More, comes out in April and is all about why diversity and inclusion don't happen and what we can do about it. So Sheree, I'm really, really excited to chat to you. It's actually a previous guest that recommended that I reach out and get in touch. Andy Jarvis, he said, you've got to get Sheree on the show. She's going to be absolutely awesome. And I said, absolutely, this sounds great. So I'd love to kind of go back to where we sort of were in your early days of growing up. You were born in 91. I'm a 95 guy, so just slightly ahead of you. And I'd love to know, like, what was it like growing up in County Tyrone as a person of colour? Because if I think about Northern Ireland, I think about County Tyrone. I think a lot of us have this impression of just rural community, and I'd love to know what your experience was of that.
Yeah, of course. So I guess important context is that I was adopted when I was 3 weeks old from Sri Lanka, as is my brother. And both our parents are white Irish people from Tyrone. Well, my dad is actually from Antrim and my mum was from Tyrone. It's a different experience. About 2% of Northern Ireland are people from Black, Asian or minority ethnic backgrounds, and that's from the last census data. It might be slightly better now, but certainly in the 90s it was much less diverse than that, especially when you think of rural communities like Tyrone, and what that means for being the only, I guess. People talk a lot about being the only when they're talking about whether it's women in engineering or women of colour and leadership and so on, and I tick all those boxes, but it's very unique when you're the only in your everyday life. So very much so, in family events, being the only brown face outside of my brother, at weddings, at christenings, at all of the family things you go to, when you go to school and you get the really big long picture of everybody in the school at once. And it was always really easy to find, like, me and my brother, because we were the only dark-skinned children at the time. And I went to primary school at a place called St. John's in King's Island, which is a phenomenal primary school. And then I went to St. Patrick's Academy in Dungannon before I went to university. And I think you can't talk about being a person of colour anywhere, but certainly not growing up somewhere in a very white space, without talking about racism. And it very much was a substantial part of me and my brother's life, unfortunately. Certainly when you're younger and you're, the cute brown baby, then everybody thinks it's a great story that your family have, adopted you and been able to give you a life that you wouldn't have been able to have in a different country. That's all well and good, but it's not so good whenever people start to, when you grow up And then you get quite a lot of racism, a lot of bullying, etc. I was bullied quite a lot, actually, in school, as was my brother. Certainly we used to get called the N-word and a lot of other slurs when we were growing up. And I always specifically remember when... So I went to the academy in Dungannon, which is on one side of Dungannon, and my brother went to the integrated college, which was like on the other side of Dungannon. And I always remember, like, when we would want to go up the town after school, when we were like sort of 15, 16 or so, and he would have to walk a different way, because when he walked past another school specifically, they would like hurl abuse at him and shout at him and say stuff. So he had to walk the longer way up the town to go, and that becomes an integral part of your life. When you get used to that sort of thing, always having to be cautious of what someone's going to say or if you're safe, and obviously the additional safety when you're a woman as well. But the other flip side of that is, like, I'm incredibly privileged to have been adopted and been able to grow up. You know, I was able to go to university and everything, albeit having to take out a lot of grants and bursaries and loans. I was on preschool meals when I was at school. I dealt with, you know, my family dealt with the different issues that it brings whenever you're not financially privileged, for sure. But I'm still incredibly privileged to have had those opportunities, because that's why I'm able to be, you know, a global director of a company now, why I'm able to travel the world training people on inclusion and, you know, prominent in my space because of that very one decision that was made whenever I was a baby. So there's definitely checks and balances at the experience, for sure.
It's amazing. So kind of like, in the midst of all you've described, how did you get into tech, and what was it about tech that really pulled you in?
So I grew up in the 90s, and what's the 90s, I think, were instrumental when you look at technology and its adoption. In that, like, gaming consoles became much more prevalent and affordable for all families. Computers and PCs, albeit massive PCs, became more commonplace in people's homes.
What was your first console?
My first console was the Sega Mega Drive, with Earthworm Jim. I loved that game, though. It's such a good game. And I remember having, you know, gaming consoles in the house and having, like, the first ever PlayStation and stuff like that. And I was always really interested in how those things were made. So, like, when you click a button on your controller, why do I jump? Why do I move? Why does that change my colour and so on? And what was really interesting for me was, like, I wanted to create those things. I didn't want to just play them. I didn't want to just be able to use, like, Microsoft Word. I wanted to make something. And so when I was in school, I did GCSE ICT, and I hated it because it was just using software. It wasn't actually making anything.
Yeah,
on the surface.
Excel, do this, do that, write out this formula.
Everything, and I didn't like it. So I did A-level computing, which was essentially computer science. Like, your first year of computer science is very similar to that. And I had a phenomenal teacher called Mr. Gribben, who's from Bracca. And he was just incredibly passionate. He was incredibly interested in what he did. He clearly loved what he did. And to be very honest, he was clearly underselling himself being a teacher. He could have been in the industry doing phenomenal, different work and, like, life-changing work that would influence much more. But he clearly cared a lot about passing on that knowledge to children, which was phenomenal. But through that, I was creating software pieces. I was, like, creating databases and all that stuff. And then I became a software engineer after I did computer science at uni. And I was a computer scientist and a software engineer for maybe about three years, before I made DE&I my full-time job. Because, I guess, to be very frank, I am really, really good at DE&I, and there are people that are better software engineers than I am.
No, that's awesome. I love that idea of, like, passing on knowledge. And, you know, you talk about, like, a natural curiosity that you had. I think I'm also a really big fan and believer in kind of using the cards that you're dealt. So the natural skills and abilities, or just privileges or circumstances that we have. I love then seeing people who then go out and kind of use that to reach other people. So in this kind of passing on of knowledge that you've committed yourself to, what are some of the key elements that you really want to underscore?
I think that whenever we talk about passing on knowledge, I think it's important to remember that knowledge means different things to different people because access is different for different people. Opportunities are not fair in the way that, you know, in an ideal world, everybody would have fair access to opportunities and growth and knowledge and so on. And that, very frankly, just isn't the way the world is, unfortunately. And for me, when I'm thinking about sort of passing on the knowledge and the expertise that I have now, it's very much about understanding and sharing the successes and the lessons learned that I have had over, you know, a decade of me doing the work that I do, over knowing what best practices are and how to make change without people having to continue to make the same mistakes that, you know, I have made, that other people have made, and so on. And I think there's a real need for that kind of, I guess, open leadership. And people talk about, you know, vulnerability and leadership a lot, but don't actually do it. It's more than just saying, you know, my mental health is difficult. It's also about that alongside, you know, what have I done that could have been better? What are the things that I've learned along the way? How have I pivoted into different careers? And how have I prioritized things like health along the way? And that's why I do quite a lot of, you know, writing for Forbes and different publications and my book, because I think there's hopefully usefulness in the stuff that I say. People seem to like it so far anyway, but I just think there, it's worth it being outside of myself, because otherwise I'm a single point of failure.
So talking about that open leadership model and being open about our mistakes and learning from each other's mistakes, what is something that you have changed your mind about? Maybe whenever you first started your role and your jobs, like, what's something that you've changed your mind on and that you have held your hands up and say, actually, this wasn't the best way to approach this or do this?
Yeah, of course. When I started doing leadership work, I was very young. So I was maybe 22, and I'm turning 30 this month. So that's very young to start doing leadership.
Absolutely.
And I was pushing myself very hard, but it also meant I was leading people in a way that I probably wouldn't do now. So, like, being too, what's the right word, too cautious with delegating is a big issue. And I see people doing it that have been doing the leadership for years and they've still not seemed to learn that's not a good idea. But I did do that in the past, and I know it meant that people that were on my team had felt like I was, you know, too micromanaging, that I wasn't giving them the autonomy to get their job done, to be able to do the stuff that they were brought on to do, because it meant that that's why they were brought on. And I learned from that very early on, and it's very important to me now that, you know, my job is to surround myself with people that I can trust and that I know are the best people for the job. And that means that my job is strategic, not operational. I should not be in the nitty-gritty or down in the grassroots of things. My job isn't to do that. My job is to provide those growth opportunities to people that want them and to do that work whilst I oversee and define a vision. And it's really important, I think, to make sure that, you know, as a leader, you have that acknowledgement that, you know, for something to be your success, it doesn't have to have you directly involved in it. You know, my success isn't just stuff that I have done, but success is also like things that people on my team do, people in the different organizations that I work with do, and so on. It doesn't have to have my name on it for it to be successful for me. And that's a really important, I think, growth of leadership.
This is kind of me going off tangent here now, but you talking about, you know, getting out of the nitty gritty and moving into more of that vision casting sort of role. I kind of think about all that in terms of stories. And for me, vision is telling stories that inspire other people to take action. So in your work with, whenever it comes to diversity and inclusion, what sort of stories do you think are unhelpful that maybe we as a society or us as companies are holding on to whenever it comes to, that hold us back from moving forward in this area?
Yeah, I think one of the main problems that happens is that people believe that because people are nice, that means that they can't be sexist or racist or ableist or whatever it might be. And that's a real problem, because the definition of nice is subjective. I can think something is nice and somebody else can think it's horrible. I can think a person is nice because they treat me differently because I'm a senior leader with a lot of privilege. Someone else who's even from a similar demographic of me that's much more junior will not have the same treatment. And the issue with niceness is that it's used as a quantifier to define whether we care about someone or not. So you'll see whenever bad things happen, every single day in the world, but whenever something happens to someone and a lot of the immediate responses are, oh, they were such a nice person, that should never have happened to them. Whenever the real point here is actually, that should have never have happened regardless, and niceness, again, is subjective. And what's important that organizations do is, I'm very data-driven, probably because I am a computer scientist at heart. It's really important to, when you are defining, you know, what is going wrong in your organization, that data is a really big part. You know, who is represented in your organization at all levels, but also perception and inclusion data is really important. How do people feel from different backgrounds around fair opportunities, management support, reward, loyalty, inclusiveness, non-discrimination, and so on? Because when you don't have that, you're able to fall onto this guise of, well, that manager's really nice, so it's obviously not their fault that no women of colour are being promoted. They're just not good enough. But actually, when you analyse your process, it's much more in-depth than that. And when you fall to niceness, you're very frankly just disregarding what's happening in the world. And if it happens in the world, it happens in your company, okay? You can't separate the two, because people exist in the world and they exist in your company. So I think what I ask of people is to be accountable and be very upfront with the rubbish and likely harming and discriminatory things that they are doing, so we can fix them.
I think that's been one of my biggest takeaways from a lot of the conversations over the last year, is there can be incredibly nice looking people with smiling faces kind of behind the steering wheel of a very broken system. And actually, a lot of the systems that companies or we as society have in place are actually doing a lot of the damage. And we're thinking, oh, that's not possible, because look how nice that person is, like you said.
Exactly.
So what are some better stories that you share with organizations to try to inspire them to take action?
I think the first thing is that people need to understand that we shouldn't need to directly identify with underrepresented people in whatever way that means, to care about the fact that the world is very unfair. Like, is it fair that black graduates take 3 times as long to find a job as opposed to white graduates when they do the same courses? No, it's not fair. Is it fair that women face statistically more discrimination and harassment in technology than men? No, it's not fair. Is it fair that LGBT plus rights are so heavily influenced by politics and religion that it means that there are places in the world where you can be put in jail or killed for being with your partner of the same sex? No, it's not fair. And that's the point here. We need to start remembering that the world doesn't revolve around us singularly. And, people are very human-centric and quite selfish as a whole. That's kind of how we're all made. But I think it's important to have those conversations where we understand that the world does exist outside of our bubble. The world does manifest and treat people differently. And the stories that we need to tell are those stories, are those really hard-hitting stories that we've seen, you know, the data that backs up all of those things that I'm saying, the fact that we know that when you're from a poorer background, for example, that you are statistically less comfortable at every single stage of the interview process than those from more wealthy backgrounds, and that you're more likely to be dropping out at video stage. Now think about the bias that means, do you know what I mean? And that's the story that we need to talk about, because what happens far too often is that people talk about the fluffy, nice stories. Oh, it's International Women's Day, or it's Black History Month, so we're going to talk about good stories. Yes, we need to talk about those good stories, but we also need to talk about the fact of how we're in the position that we're in now. I wrote about this a lot in my book because I really hate it.
Yeah.
And I did a Forbes piece on it a few weeks ago as well, around we must be honest about exclusion if we're going to tackle inclusion.
Wow.
And those are the stories I talk about. Those are the stories I share, because I need people to, quite frankly, wake up and stop pretending that when we talk about exclusion, we're just talking about small things, but we're talking about very big things, very big policy changes. Like, even NI, we only just had significant LGBT plus rights change around gay marriage, I think it was last year or the year before.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we have to hold ourselves to account here, and certainly that doesn't just mean small actions. That means policy changes, that means political changes. And I was doing an interview for a conference, I think it was a week or so ago, And they asked me, is my book political? And I was like, inclusion is political. How can it not be? Do you know what I mean? It's entirely based on who's in power and what they care about. And if underrepresented people are not in that sphere, then it's political. So
absolutely. I think it's really interesting to see, you know, growing up and seeing Northern Ireland change so much. The conversation is obviously still to, not even to a certain extent, it still is dominated whenever we talk about inclusion in terms of the two camps of the Protestant and Catholic. It's so interesting to now see, particularly over the last year, we as a nation starting to grapple with all these other different forms of identity and layers of complexities that now have to be laid on top of this, you know, Protestant and Catholic framework. I wonder, like, how do you go about juggling your own identity? And that's a bit of a weird question, but I was just thinking, like, you know, you're obviously, part of your identity is you're Sri Lankan. Part of your identity is you're from Tyrone. Part of your identity is you live in London. And it's much more complex than I think what we stereotypically view as, oh, I'm a Protestant or I'm a Catholic. So how do you yourself juggle that? And then also what does it mean for you to be Northern Irish?
I think there's a lot to balance. And I was raised Catholic, but I'm an atheist. Like now, when I got married, we had a civil partnership and it wasn't religious at all, because I'm not religious, but I was raised in an Irish Republican household, as you could probably guess when I'm from Killarney. and the influence that has on how you think about things, and things that you also have to challenge from a biased perspective as you get older as well, which I've had to do. I about 3 years ago, I went back to Sri Lanka, and there was a whole big media storm. There was like hotlines and stuff, so that I was trying to find my biological family. To be very honest, it was out of sheer nosiness and curiosity, because I never had the necessity of, a lot of adopted people sometimes feel like there's something missing and that they want to find that. That wasn't the case for me. It was more along the lines of, I had photos that my dad had taken of my biological birth mother, and she was 26, 27 in them, and I was about 26, 25, and we both looked very similar. That's and incredible. I was like, maybe we could find her. I have enough of a profile to use that to try and see if any Sri Lankan media would be interested. And so a colleague at the time introduced me to like the equivalent of like BBC out there called News First. And so they ran the story on primetime news every night. There was a hotline to call in tips if you knew anything about the story. It turned out that like all of my birth certificates were all false information, which happened quite regularly. So the only thing that was based in truth was the photos. So everything was hooked off of these photos. We had people coming forward pretending to be her, trying to get money and stuff like that. But then they eventually found her just by coincidence. So someone in the army in Sri Lanka had seen the TV ad or the TV piece, recognized her, and they went to speak to her in the village she lived in. She still looked very, very similar to the photo, apart from being much older. So it was a relatively easy find, and we did DNA tests and everything.
Wow.
And so I went back to Sri Lanka, and that's whenever you talk about a conflict of identities, that's where for me it really became a very big thing, because I was like, I am of Sri Lankan origin, but I'm very much Irish, and I'm very proud to be Irish. I'm very proud of my name. Like when I got married, I kept my name. So my husband is McCrory, which is a very Irish name. but I kept Atchison because my dad spent years trying to have kids, and it was really important for me to keep that name, even though he wanted me. He was like, why are you not changing your name? What's going on? It was a big thing for him. When I went to Sri Lanka, quite a lot of the news places there were pushing this narrative onto me, like, oh, do you feel like you've found like the missing part of you? Do you feel like you know, you're coming home? And I was like, I think they didn't expect me to be so blunt, because there's quite a few high profile interviews where I say to them, actually, no, that's not accurate at all. Yeah. And, you know, this is just a jigsaw part of me, and Sri Lankan is one part of it. When I came back, and certainly I've always very closely identified with being Irish because of how proud my family was to be Irish and what that meant for me. But certainly as someone who, you know, is married to an Irish man, all my family is Irish. Most of my friends are Irish, bar the friend that I met when I've been in Belfast and then in London, really. And there's the balance of, you know, what does that mean for me now? And for me, it just means that I'm incredibly proud of where I come from, the history that Ireland has, and the richness that that history and culture has is really, really important to me. Like, and I, you know, this, the primary schools I went to and stuff, I learned how to speak Irish to a certain level.
Oh, really?
I used to do Irish dancing and win medal at the Fish and stuff like that. So I'm not good at any of those things anymore. But there's the balance, and I think it's, people expect different things from me. Like when I speak to Irish people, and I feel very connected to, like when I speak to people like who are from back home, I feel a sense of, you know, I guess representation and stuff. But if people in Sri Lanka are speaking to me, there's this almost like, but you're Sri Lankan first, and I'm like, but I don't think I am, because that's not how I really feel. So it's a balancing act at times. Like I was saying to Sean, my husband, not that long ago, that, you know, when I see people on TV, and, you know, people talk about representation on TV, and, you know, for people that typically look like me, that's usually when you would see like women of color or women of Southeast Asian descent and so on. But for me, representation is when I see people from Ireland as well. Like, I remember when Derry Girls came out, and I was like, oh my God, this is exactly like when I was at school. All of those people are the same people I went to school with. The accents, the way that they were living, the uniforms, everything all was very close to how representation feels for me. And it's a balancing act, and it's different because, you know, like you said, Ireland is, and certainly Northern Ireland, is very, you know, green and orange. But I think it's evolving, certainly when there is more diversity from different facets. It's a lot to process sometimes.
I can imagine. How have you seen, you know, the country change, or even how have you seen Belfast change over the years? Because I know you worked there.
Yeah, so like I lived in Tyrone until I was 18, and then I lived in Belfast for 9 or 10 years.
What was that transition like? Just a quick insert there. Was that an easy transition? Was it a weird transition?
I think it was relatively easy because Belfast, whilst different, it's still very comforting in that it's like still similar but different. It's a bigger, but it's the same at the same time, which I liked, and that's why I stayed in Belfast for ages. But certainly the change of going from, you know, Tyrone to Belfast to London, and I've seen Northern Ireland change. Like I've seen the politics change, and I don't think you can talk about NI without talking about politics, as unfortunate as that is, because it's intrinsically linked to how people are raised, the communities that you're involved with, the sports that you're involved with.
It's identity stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, like you can't separate the two, which is also unfortunate. But I think I've seen it evolve. I've seen how, like Belfast, for example, as a city, the evolution is phenomenal. The tourism, certainly before COVID anyway, has been such a phenomenal boom. Around the tourism industry, around how the city has evolved into somewhere that people want to go to, that people want to come from, you know, different parts of the world and experience what it's like to live there, experience what it's like to go on holiday there. And we've seen, you know, an evolution of leadership, like different people like me, people from different backgrounds doing really big things in NI and using that almost as like the landing platform to jump and do something even bigger, but with that as the core and as the root. And I think that that's one of the really good things about NI, is that there's the ability and the welcoming ability to do things like that, to start something really big and either keep it big and stay in NI, or, you know, branch out and go even wider. And I think that evolution is a really big part of that. I do hope it keeps evolving though, because there are obviously things that could do with being updated.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm reading a book at the minute. It's called For the Love of Cities, and it's all about city making and city planning. And he makes a really interesting point. I lived in New York City for 3 years, so I have a little bit of experience of being lost in that big, big sort of environment. But he says one of the great thing about smaller cities is your ability to make an impact.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talk about how you were able to... You didn't exactly say this is how I interpreted, so please feel free to call me out. Like, you can become a big fish in a small pond, and you can use that to leverage other great opportunities elsewhere. So I do think that that there is a real opportunity in people who do come to the city, whether they are local or international. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I did with Women Who Code when I branched it from San Francisco to Belfast first. So Women Who Code is the world's largest non-profit globally dedicated to women in technology. And about seven or eight years ago, when I became a software engineer, I wanted to do something about the lack of gender diversity in the first instance in the industry. And so I found them, they run free monthly meetups in all of their locations, but they weren't across the UK or really across EMEA at all. So I branched them firstly to Belfast. So Belfast was the starting point for me, the launch pad, where I then branched to Bristol, Edinburgh, London, down south in Dublin, and then also across different parts of Europe. And I now sit as an advisory board member for the non-profit because we have 230,000 global members. Wow. We give over $1 million worth of scholarships to women in tech per year. But I now have appointed loads of local leaders, and that's their job now. Their role is like the leadership team in Belfast, for example. That's nothing to do with me now because there are incredibly phenomenal people running that. But I started it in NI, and I started something and made it really successful, and then I just branched it and exploded it, and that's why the work I do now is global. So there's, like you said, that real ability to make a big impact in a city, which is no mean feat.
Mm. Completely left field. What are some of the biggest lessons that your parents have passed on to you?
Me and my dad were very close. My dad passed away in November just last year. So still really not that long ago. And we didn't get to see each other for a year because of COVID, because he was very high risk and he was in the hospital and unfortunately passed away unexpectedly. And I always, like, when I think about him and when I was doing his like speech and stuff at his funeral, my dad was, I don't know what the right word is, probably quite pig-headed, but in a good way. In a good way, not in the way that he's a horrible person, but in the way that, like, he did not take nonsense from anybody. He was very, straight down the middle, salt of the earth. If you don't like it, tough.
Yeah.
He didn't care. He also, like, certainly as he got older, so he was 69, or he would have, his 69th birthday actually would have been next week, so he was 68. And if you didn't like what he said, he really did not care. And he was really well known, certainly in NI, and had done a lot of work around like the evolution of Ireland and all of the stuff that was happening years and years ago. And he always taught me, I guess, to just not take any nonsense. And I don't take nonsense because I don't have to. And that was a really good lesson that he always gave me, was that to, I guess, hold yourself and give yourself the level of respect that you would give other people. So don't undersell yourself. Don't be willing to accept something from someone just because, hold yourself to the level that you know you deserve better and deserve more. And the only thing that I'd say that I probably wouldn't take from him is his lack of tact, in that like he had no filter. And certainly when he was older and he was in the hospital quite a lot, he like did not care who heard him say what. Sure. He'd be on the phone to me and I would be like,
Dad, why are you, stop,
you're like, stop slagging off the man beside you, he's right there, he can hear you. And he would like just not care. So I definitely didn't take that lesson from him, but yeah, certainly the lesson around putting yourself first when you can and not accepting less than you deserve.
Harder question perhaps. All throughout the summer and all of the conversations that spawned off the back of a lot of the Black Lives Matter movement and the conversations, and even locally there was so much kind of happening, and we were thinking, okay, what's next, and inevitably things fall out of the kind of news cycle and the momentum gets smaller and smaller. I kind of just feel left in the midst of all this of, okay, all of this happened. Now what? Like, what can I do? Like, I'm not in a big institution. I'm not in local government. I, like most people listening, live a pretty ordinary life doing ordinary things. What is our response to this and how can we help push forward diversity and inclusion in our country?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the murder of George Floyd last year and the murders before that and all of the police brutality that sort of has mobilised the Black Lives Matter movements globally, you know, this is still happening. Like, just, I think it was yesterday or the day before, there is a case of police, certainly white police in America, pepper spraying a 9-year-old black girl because she's screaming she wants her dad. Crazy. And putting handcuffs on her. So, like, these things are happening day in and day out. It's not stopping. And what we need, people like that are not black, like I'm not black either, so non-black people, we need people to keep talking about this, to keep listening to the news, to keep holding relatives to account. Like, when you're at Christmas dinner or you're at home and somebody says something that's either casually or very racist, that you call it out and that you say, well, actually, why are you saying that? And that means that you're putting yourself in the firing line, of course, because I know that there's a lot of flippant racism in Ireland and anywhere, but certainly in, when you're back home and in those environments, was to hold those people to account. Like, maybe, yes, we can't change policy, or you're not a senior leader in a business or whatever it is, but you do have a family potentially, you do have friends, you do have circles that you can talk to people about this stuff. And that's what we need, that the awareness piece and the education piece must be led by allies like us. It must be led by people like us continually talking about the issues that are happening. So, for example, today we just seen the newest Green Park report, which has been going since 2014, is the first time since its creation that there are no black executives at top companies, and that there has been increases in representation for all other minority ethnicities, but not black people.
Wow.
Now, this is what I mean. We have to talk about this. We have to post about it. We have to share it on our Twitters, our LinkedIns, send it to your family, talk about it, talk to your friends, and keep people accountable. And that's what I would ask people, is that we all have an ability to hold someone to account, whether it's yourself or somebody else, I don't know. But being willing to do that is incredibly important, because the journey and the fixing of the situation we're in can't just be on, in this instance, black people. The issues around sexism and everything else that exists can't just be on the people it affects. It has to be bigger than that, and that's where all of our roles are.
Talk to me about age in organizations, and particularly, you know, like tech startups. What do you think the role of an older workforce could play in that? How could we make that happen, or if that's even relevant, why is it important?
Age is incredibly important, because age brings different experiences, and age is a big part of inclusion, because you should have a workforce that is reflective of your business, and most people don't. And certainly when it comes to startups, what's important to think about is if you're creating something that is for society as a whole and not for a very niche market, whether it's, you know, for millennials or younger people or whatever it might be, how can you appropriately create something that works for people that are older and so on, if you aren't considering their input, if you aren't considering their requirements, their testing and so on? And what companies need to do when they're on that journey is, very often people think that you just hire someone in, or a few people in that are of a different demographic, in this case older, and that's it. But actually, age inclusion is a much bigger piece, because it's typically around, you know, flexible working, around the benefits that you can or can't provide and why you can or can't provide those, and also the different ways that people progress and how clear it is around who is progressing and who isn't. Because there will be bias, for example, in startups, to positive bias towards younger people and people that are more suited to the potential culture if it's a younger startup. And that's a really big piece of work. And what I also want companies to do is, like, if you can't, let's say you don't make profit at the moment and you're unable to provide benefits that do work for the masses, like older people and everybody else that's not in the very small age group that you're trying to fit, then be upfront about that and say that. Don't try and lie and say, oh, you know, our workplace will work for everybody. But be upfront and say that, you know, right now we don't have the budget to be able to provide, you know, the different types of benefits that maybe older people or people further on in their lives would like. But this is what we'll want to do in the future. And that's, again, the accountability piece is really important in that.
It's the first time I'm rolling out this question, so feel free to take a few seconds or not answer it at all. If you had a magic wand and you could do one thing for Northern Ireland, whether it be passing a policy or, I don't know, popping up a new building of some sort, like, You've got one wish for Northern Ireland. What is it?
I think my one wish for Northern Ireland would certainly be neutralising politics. I think it's there's so much exclusion that continues to happen because everything is very, like we say, green and orange. People vote in that way even if they don't fully agree with policies or fully agree with what's happening, because they will never vote for someone else, or maybe they'll vote for like Alliance or somebody in the middle. But like, it's, I wish that we could continue to move past that, because I think there's so much history in NI and we should respect the history. We should not whitewash over the top of it and pretend things haven't happened that have been atrocious that have happened. But I want us to continue to evolve and recognize that, you know, there are things that we can do together. There are things that are incredibly important that we don't want to, like, have children that just are segregated right from the start. Like, if we can avoid that, then let's do that. And so I guess that would be my one wish for NI.
That's brilliant. I like that. That was a good beta test. We'll be using that again. So kind of then landing the plane with a couple of stock questions, and take these whatever way you want, okay?
Right.
Out of everything you've experienced so far, what has been your greatest challenge and how were you able to overcome it?
My greatest challenge is probably balance. So balancing being a senior leader in an industry, having my own business, writing a book, having a partner that I don't want to end up getting divorced from, all of the balance.
Must be real, that, yeah.
Yeah, all of the balance that comes into that, because it's not easy. I'm also 29, so I'm not even like halfway through my life yet, I don't think. And the having to take deliberate action to get balance has been an experience, because there are definitely times where I've lost it and I've lost the balance. So that's definitely the main one that comes to my mind for that.
How do you say no?
How do I say no? I just say no now, because I'm in a position where if something isn't either useful for me from a growth opportunity, or I'm not the right person for the job, then I just say no. Because again, that's a big privilege that I know I don't have to say yes to everything, because I already have a lot of clout with my name. And so I'm very comfortable saying no now, but I certainly wasn't always comfortable saying no.
It's awesome. I think it's back to what you're saying about your dad, of having that level of respect for yourself as well, isn't it?
Exactly.
Greatest success?
The greatest success, wow. I think from a professional perspective, whenever Forbes reached out to me to ask me if I wanted to be a contributor, and that was in 2019, I think, that was one of the things where I was like, I know what I'm doing is worthy of people listening to it, because I was already writing for like different publications and stuff ad hoc. But when an organization like that reaches out and is like, we want you to contribute regularly, are you interested? It's a pretty big thing. So I think for me, from a professional perspective, that's absolutely it.
If you could take anyone from Northern Ireland, dead or alive, out for a cup of coffee or a pint, who would you take? Where would you take them and why?
I'm probably going to be quite soppy and I'd say I'd take my dad if I could. I would like to be able to go for a drink with him again, and he could have a shandy and I could have a gin. That would be nice.
Where would you go?
There's a place, where is it? It's called The Stables, and nice. It's on the coast. And he always loved it. So anytime he would come to Belfast, when he would visit, like whenever I lived back home, him and my brother would come up to visit every sort of 2 weeks, or we would go back home. And it would not matter where we would want to take him. Like, we took him to the Barking Dog, we took him to a whole load of different places. And he always wanted to go there every time it was his turn to pick.
It's just not The Stables, sure it isn't.
That's it, it's just not The Stables. So we always went there, but I would love to go back there. And I'm hoping whenever I'm able to come back home, that whenever lockdowns and stuff lift, whenever that is, that me, my husband and my brother can go out there for dinner to celebrate him.
That's so awesome. Yeah, toast to shandy, that'd be nice.
That's it.
Favourite place to get ice cream in Northern Ireland?
Oh my goodness. So when we used to live in Belfast, we lived outside of Belfast in Castlereagh.
Oh yeah.
And we used to spend a lot of time in Helens Bay, because it's a nice wee drive and we have a dog. And the ice cream van there is at my favourite place, just legend. Because it's like an ice cream van. It was always beside the beach. We would get one for the dog as well. So yeah, that was definitely my favourite.
What's your order?
My order? I just get a normal 99.
Yeah? But sauce? No sauce?
No, I don't like sauce, but my husband gets like absolutely everything on it. Where it's almost a load of toppings with just a side of ice cream. Like, all right, Sean.
Yeah. Favorite takeaway in Northern Ireland?
Oh, okay. So I have to choose one. I have two. So The first one is when I lived in Belfast and lived in Castlereagh. There's a fish shop called John Dory's, which has won loads of awards and stuff like that. And it was literally, you would walk 2 minutes down the hill from where we lived, and it was right there. So it was my number one for that. And then when my dad is from Carnlough, which is on the coast. And we used to go there quite a lot when we were younger, but me and Sean would drive there every so often for to relax, and just it's a nice, really lovely wee seaside village. And again, the fish and chips right beside the water, because you literally cross the road to the cafe, cross back over, and then you're sitting where the water is.
Class.
That was definitely my favorite, and that's one of the things I love about NI. Like, even when you live in a city, you can drive 20 minutes or an hour, and you're in the proper countryside, or you're by the water. I definitely miss that a lot.
Lizzie interviewing, but what's your order?
For those two places, it's fish and chips. The only other one that I would definitely call out is in Culloden, there's a Chinese called Double Up. And I remember it, even when I was growing up, it still got the exact same sign on the front, all faded and everything. But I always remember the guy who ran it would give my dad one of those wee calendars that you always used to get every year at Christmas, and a card and everything else. And whenever we're back home, we still go to that Chinese. So yeah, there's my top three.
It's class. No, always love asking that. It's interesting to see what comes up. Brilliant. Final question, Sheree. It's a question we always end with, and it's if it's not broke, why fix it? If you could go back in time to an 18-year-old Sheree who's just on her way to Belfast, moving to the big smoke, and a couple of minutes of her time, what sort of things would you say to her?
I would probably tell her to speak up whatever you want to, as opposed to sometimes worrying about what other people think, because I don't do that anymore, because I just genuinely don't care. But that was certainly an evolution to get to that stage. So I'd tell her to speak up, and I would also tell her to be ready to push against quite a lot of stuff, because it's not easy when you do this work, and certainly even from, when I was a software engineer, you're challenging things because you're underrepresented in the industry as a whole, and certainly in leadership and everything else. And I would prep her for that, because it's not an easy journey, but I guess if I knew in advance, I would at least have my shield ready, which would probably make the journey a bit easier.
Oh, that's brilliant. Well, look, if you've really enjoyed today's conversation like I have, I highly, highly recommend picking up a pre-ordered copy of Sheree's book, Demanding More. It's out in April. It's obviously where you would expect it, on Amazon. Any other places you want to push?
You can buy it anywhere. I'll share a discount link and stuff when you buy it directly from publisher. So it's literally on any bookstore. It's on Waterstones, it's on WH Smith, it's on with the publisher, it's everywhere. So if you just Google Demanding More in my name, you will find it.
That's awesome. Absolutely love that. And I want to say thanks again to NI Connections for making this interview possible. If you'd like to find out more amazing diaspora stories, you can head to their website at niconnections.com. They have a great monthly newsletter where they feature really just stories like Sheree's of people who are from this place and have gone on to do amazing things. We've also done over 180 conversations with interesting people from Northern Ireland. You can get all of our stuff at bestofbelfast.org. And other than that, Sheree, just want to say thank you so much for sharing everything you did and for spending your time with us, more importantly.
Yeah, of course. Thank you very much for having me.
Hello, my name is Simon Worthington, and I am based in Port Stewart. I am the editor of Turf and Grain magazine, an independent magazine which is committed to sharing the stories, experiences and ideas of the people of Ireland. I listen to Best of Belfast because it does the same thing for Northern Ireland, and it shows us all that Northern Ireland has a better story to tell than what is often represented in the mainstream media. My favorite episode is the episode with Ryan Crown. Ryan is someone I know and someone whose amazing career I followed quite closely over the years. I support the podcast financially just because it's really important for independent media to receive backing, because this is a really important space within our society, and this podcast is just doing a really amazing thing for Belfast, if I'm honest. If you've been on the fence about joining the Producers Club and would miss Best of Belfast if it wasn't here, I'd highly recommend considering joining it today. You can do that over at bestofbelfast.org, and I look forward to chatting to you in the WhatsApp group soon. Thanks.